From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the music industry, including the latest mega mergers and disputes about music on the internet, with Bill Flanagan. He's Senior Vice President and Editorial Director of VH1 and author of A&R, a new novel about life at a multinational record company. Also, rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at the early days of the British band The Clash, and Jeff Nunberg takes apart another phrase in today's corporate jargon, thought leader. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fire officials in Washington state say they're getting a handle on the fire raging through the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Tom Bonsey of Washington Public Radio is in Benton City, near where the fire blackened more than 190,000 acres.
The thing all the firefighters keep repeating over and over again is how fast this fire moved, and then the amazing thing is how quickly it burned out when it bumped against a road or an acres of parking lot or against a river. Overnight, the fire, at one point, according to the sheriff, moved 20 miles in an hour and a half.
The fire was sparked by a fatal car crash on Tuesday. At one point, officials say it threatened a building on the Hanford nuclear site where radioactive waste was stored. The tobacco industry called its last witness today in the punitive damages phase of a landmark Florida tobacco trial. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
A vice president of Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company testified she was personally sorry that people have suffered and wished she could undo it. Trudy Bourgeois was the final tobacco executive to take the witness stand as the industry tries to persuade a Miami jury that it doesn't deserve a multi-billion-dollar punitive damage verdict in the class action smoker case. The jury has already found that tobacco companies make a deadly and addictive product and conspired to hide the dangers of smoking. In about 2 weeks, the six-member panel will begin deliberating how much to award in lump sum punitive damages for the entire class of Florida smokers. That's estimated to be between 300 and 600,000 people. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Now that the Elian Gonzalez case is over, Attorney General Janet Reno says she'll review immigration procedures to see if they need to be changed. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
One day after Elian Gonzalez and his father returned to Cuba, Reno said she will work with immigration officials to see how to avoid the kind of legal fight that entangled the boy. One possible flaw, immigration regulations do not specify at what age a child can apply for asylum without the consent of his parents. Elian's Miami relatives tried to persuade the courts that the six-year-old boy was old enough to speak for himself, and the courts rejected that. However, Reno would not say what age is the proper one. The attorney general said she had mixed feelings about the boy's departure.
And yet, in the end, he is with his father, and I am glad of that. I just wish he were with his father in a democratic, free country.
Reno said right until the last minute she had hoped that Juan Miguel Gonzalez would choose to stay in the U.S. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street, and the Dow Industrials lost 130 points, or 1.2%, to close at 10,398 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 63 points, or 1.6%, to close at 3877. This is NPR News. A police SWAT team has surrounded a resort hotel at Disney World in Florida, where a man's reported to be holding his young son and a hotel worker hostage. The hotel has been evacuated. Police say the man's demanding to see his estranged wife. IBM announced today that it has built the world's fastest supercomputer. The computer will be used at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California to simulate nuclear testing. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The computer called ASCII White is capable of some 12.3 trillion calculations per second. The computer is part of the United States Stockpile Stewardship Program, aimed at ensuring that nuclear weapons will still work without having to actually detonate them. The computer gets its tremendous speed by having many processors work in parallel. Experts say it won't run a word processor faster than an average PC, but for tasks that can be divided up, like simulating the many bits of an exploding atomic bomb or modeling the global climate, The supercomputer would run some 32,000 times faster than a desktop machine. Scientists are divided as to the usefulness of using computers to simulate explosions, and some have criticized the stockpile stewardship program as welfare for the defense labs. IBM begins delivering the computer next week. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
The Illinois legislature voted overwhelmingly today to suspend the state sales tax on gasoline for 6 months. Lawmakers demanded that the 5% savings be passed on to consumers, meaning that the price per gallon could drop by as much as 10 cents a gallon, depending on the area. The legislature was called into special session by Governor George Ryan, who promised to sign the bill into law today. The suspension is expected to cost the state $180 million. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The music industry is being shaken up by mega mergers and the free distribution of music on the internet. My guest Bill Flanagan has written a new novel about changes in the music industry. It's called A&R. A&R stands for Artists and Repertoire, the business of finding and nurturing talent. The novel looks at the industry through the eyes of a 30-year-old talent scout who leaves an independent record label to become head of A&R at a major conglomerate. Author Bill Flanagan is Senior Vice President and Editorial Director of VH1, where he created the show Storytellers and Legends. He's the former editor of Musician Magazine and author of Written in My Soul, a collection of conversations with songwriters, and a book about U2. I asked Flanagan why he made the central character in his new novel an A&R man.
Well, the A&R men are in a terrific position. They're sort of the link between the artists and the record company. They're the people who go out and find the talent, who bring the talent in, and who nurture them along and supposedly make big hits. Now, if the A&R man has success, that is to say, if the artist he brings in has success, then he can become real rich, real powerful. But the A&R man's only as good as his latest hit or his latest hit artist. And if he doesn't bring in somebody who gets a big hit, the A&R man is out. And as an A&R man who read the book said to me the other day, and there's nowhere to go. The job doesn't prepare you for anything else in life. So it's a pretty dramatic position to be in. And of course, it also, just in terms of kind of making an exciting narrative, he's the person in the hot seat. He's the person who has to sell the label to the artist and the artist to the label. And that's not something that happens once. That happens over and over and over with every record, with every decision, with every argument. He's the man in the middle.
Do you think the role of A&R has changed as the whole record industry has changed?
Oh, it's changed tremendously. The A&R, in fact, the name A&R, Artists and Repertoire, used to mean in the 40s and 50s kind of exactly what it says. The A&R man would find a song that he thought was going to be a hit. He'd find White Christmas. He'd book a studio. He'd hire the orchestra. He'd hire the arranger. He'd get the sheet music together. And then he'd say, I think this is a good one for Bing Crosby. Let's bring Bing in. And if by any chance Bing didn't pull it off, or the A&R man didn't think it worked well with Bing, he'd say, well, let's try it again with Rosemary Clooney. So the A&R man was very much assembling all the pieces of the puzzle. In the 60s, with the Beatles and Bob Dylan, the old A&R men and the whole old record industry was shoved aside, because now the artists were self-sufficient. They wrote their songs, they produced their own records, they booked the session, they played the instruments themselves. So the A&R man evolved into something different. He became sort of the hand holder, or some artists would say the guy with the hand in their pocket, but he became the one who searched the world for the next Beatles, for the next Rolling Stones, for the next Billy Joel. And he became much more of a kind of a the cowboy who rides into town, you know, the guy who walks into the saloon and says, anybody in here want to challenge me to a game of fast draw?
The A&R guy in your novel starts off at an independent record label and is lured to a major label, you know, to a big corporate label through the offer of a bigger salary and a big percentage of profits. What are the problems he faces at this big corporate label that he didn't face at the independent label?
Well, probably what happens to Cantone, who's the kind of idealistic young A&R man, is that he sort of is still innocent enough, naive enough, or good-hearted enough to think that it's all about the music, that it's all about falling in love with a band, falling in love with a singer, and then sharing that with the world. And I think what he comes up against at the major label, he probably would have come up against at some point, wherever he wherever he was. And that's the fact that when millions of dollars are riding on it, it is big business, and there's no way to avoid becoming a businessman. And the thing that he wrestles with through the whole novel is how far he'll compromise himself. I think it's something that people have to face in every job. You know, I picked the music business and the record business because it's something I know very well, and because these things are kind of in bold relief there. But to tell you the truth, I think the book could have been set in almost any sort of business, because people do face these things. They do come in thinking of themselves as idealistic and in it for the best reasons, and very often they find as they go along that they've compromised more than they ever meant to.
One character in the novel describes the record industry as playing a game of moral jujitsu, where standing up for doing the right thing gets flipped around to become evidence of selfishness. What does he mean?
That's a scene I really like, because it's a scene I think it plays out in all kinds of places a lot. There's a scene where Cantone, the idealistic A&R man, gets a tape in the mail by a folk singer named Paul Slocum. This is someone who's maybe 50 years old, has never had a hit, but is really, really good. And Cantone listens to it over and over and says, "Boy, I know that this is not going to succeed in an NSYNC Britney Spears world, but it's such a good record. There's such good songs." He goes to his boss and says, "JB, look, I'm not going to tell you that this is going to sell millions of records, but we make so much money on all these other acts anyway. Couldn't we put this one out just because it's good music, just because it's beautiful? Surely we could afford to do that one time." And his boss looks at him and says, "Jim, I never knew you could be so selfish." And goes on to explain that to try and impose his own taste on the public who do not share that taste is an act of selfishness. Basically, Booth says, go ahead, you know, take this guy's tapes home, listen to him all you want, but when you come to work, your job is to serve the public, and anything else is just self-indulgence. And Jim comes out sort of shaken, because he was prepared for all kinds of financial or commercial arguments, but he wasn't prepared to be told that doing something for altruistic reasons meant that he had to be selfish. And he describes moral jujitsu as taking anything that's done for the right intentions and saying that it's evidence of elitism or selfishness or whatever else you want to do. And I think it happens an awful lot. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of that. I think, like everyone, I'm awful glad that I'm glad communism fell. I'm glad that Europe is free. I'm happy to see prosperity as much as the next guy. But I do think that it's kind of like, ideologically, the other guy jumped off the seesaw and we went flying through the air. Then there's a kind of a real hardcore notion afoot right now that if it makes money, it's good. And it's not just good financially, it's good in every way. It's morally good, it's ethically good. We're into some kind of super high Protestant 1902 mentality that seems to have spread up and down.
Bill Flanagan is my guest, and he's the author of the new novel, A&R, which is set in the record industry. He's also senior vice president and editorial director at VH1. Well, big record company labels are getting even bigger. Mega corporations are becoming even more mega now in the record industry. Seagram's bought Universal, and that shook up the record world. Now a French company, Vivendi, is buying Seagram's. What would this unite under one company if the deal goes through?
Well, I'll tell you what's astonishing about the Vivendi deal. I hope this isn't too high on his side, but I think it's kind of interesting. Last year, in January of 1999, the Seagram's deal went through, and it was, I can't tell you what convulsions it caused in the record industry, because what happened was Seagram's, the big liquor company, had already bought Polygram, which was a mega company itself. Polygram owned Motown and A&M and all these other great labels. Then Seagram's, already having absorbed Polygram, bought Universal, MCA, which, aside from being a big film company and all kinds of other things, had another bunch of great labels, Geffen Records and Uni Records and MCA Records and all these different things. So suddenly, two companies that had already swallowed everything were swallowed by a bigger company. And many, many, many lifetime record executives were thrown out of work. And many, many terrific artists were dropped, people, because they weren't selling multi-millions, there wasn't any room for them anymore. So that was shocking enough, and that was sort of a period of a few weeks when layoff after layoff hit these people in their mid-40s and 50s who'd been in it forever, when they realized that the old record business was never coming back. Now, here's what's amazing. Cut to a year and a half later, and Since then, AOL has bought Time Warner, which also bought EMI, which is Capitol Records and the Beatles and Frank Sinatra and everything, and made that one big company. The company I work for, Viacom, has absorbed CBS and all kinds of other stuff, and I'm really happy about that. I make a lot of dough. I don't want to be a hypocrite. But suddenly, a year and a half after the Seagram's deal rocked the music industry, the folks at Seagram's are saying, well, we can no longer compete in a world of AOL, Time Warner, EMI. We're not big enough. We don't have enough assets. All we have is music, pretty much. So therefore, Vivendi, a French company, which basically is in the water and power utilities business, I mean, they also make cell phones and a lot of other things, has come in as a white knight and absorbed Seagram's. So it is astonishing. I mean, Jonah would be amazed to see how many bigger and bigger leviathans can come and keep swallowing the next one and swallowing the next one and swallowing the next one. And I think what's most amazing is that the deal that was considered to be the most gigantic thing ever in the music industry in January of 1999, creating the ultimate super company that was going to plow over everything else in the road, had become, by June of 2000, something that was, well, we're not really big enough to compete against the new mega giant super leviathans that have sprung up in the last 12 months.
How do you think that the mega, mega, mega companies are changing what life is like for an artist who's signed to a major record label?
That's sort of the issue boiling in the background of A&R, because let me say something about the way that the record business was from the early 60s or the 50s until now, until a couple of years ago, until the late 90s. I'm not saying that the guys who ran the record companies, especially some of the small record companies, weren't sort of pirates and shady characters, because in many cases they were. They were signing people to terrible contracts. They were stealing the publishing. They were doing all the terrible things we've heard about. However, what I would say, if I were being devil's advocate, what I'd say in their defense is that they were in it for life, and they were music men. And you did know that if you shook hands with one of these guys, admittedly, you should put your wallet in your boot before you do, but if you shook hands with one of these guys in 1965, then he was still going to be there until they dragged his cold body away from the desk. He was going to be there forever. His company was going to be there forever. What that meant we had, that we've kind of lost in the record business, is that there was long-term security. There was a sense that you were making a deal with a company, and very often with an individual, who was going to be there for life. So if it were Columbia Records in the early 60s, and you were Bob Dylan or Paul Simon, and you went in, then there was every expectation that if you sold a certain number of records, you were going to be with Columbia forever. And what it meant from Columbia's side was that they could afford to stick with you for a long time. Bob Dylan's first record sold nothing. Simon and Garfunkel's first record sold nothing. Bruce Springsteen's first record sold nothing. Billy Joel's first record sold nothing. In many cases, it wasn't until the third or fourth or fifth album that these guys started breaking through, till they even really started figuring out how to do what it was they were going to do so well. That was fine with the company. They were patient. They had them forever. That's completely disappeared. No one at a major record company now feels he has any job security. They're not even sure there are going to be record companies as we know them now in another 5 years. And with all the mergers, the layoffs, you don't know who your boss is going to be 6 months from now. So people are very, very desperate to get a hit as quick as possible. A, it'll keep them from being fired. I'm talking about the record executives now. But B, it's how they build their portfolio, with the expectation that they'll be changing jobs soon anyway. So the notion of, here's Neil Young, he's a little rough, he has kind of a funny voice, but he's got enormous talent, let's sign him because he's going to mean something over the next 10 years, is completely gone. It is now a matter of, get me somebody real good looking who can dance, and we'll get a bunch of hacks in here to come up with a catchy pop song, and we'll make a video, and we'll get it on MTV fast. And even if it's over in 6 months, I'll have made my $1 million. I'll have my kids' college fund covered. I'll have got my beach house. And then if the whole thing goes to hell, well, I'm taken care of. So there's no loyalty up, there's no loyalty down.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Flanagan. He's Senior Vice President and Editorial Director at VH1 and author of a new novel set in the record industry called A&R, as an artist in repertoire.
Also, it's in Assault and Robbery, as one of the characters points out. To a record person, A&R means artist in repertoire. To a cop, it means assault and robbery.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Flanagan, author of the new novel A&R, which is set in the record industry, and senior vice president and editorial director at VH1. As you've pointed out, for people who are signed to major labels, A&R doesn't mean artisan repertoire, it means assault and robbery. There are a bunch of recording artists now who had been signed or still are signed to major labels and have become disgusted with the kind of contracts that major labels offer. What are the typical complaints that you hear, the kind of complaints that are driving some major artists to leave major record companies?
The kind of contracts that have remained in force in the record industry would be laughed at in any comparable business. They'd be laughed at in the book business. They'd be laughed at in the movie business. For example, an artist working for a record company or signed to a record company has to pay all the costs of making the record and, in fact, doesn't see any money until all those costs are paid back out of his royalty. However, the record company owns the recording in perpetuity. The record company owns the recording even if they drop the artist and delete the recording. Now, if the sad day comes when Random House drops my book, then the rights to the book revert to me. And if I can find another publisher to bring it out, then I'll find the other publisher to bring it out. In a record company, if Bob Dylan lost his record deal tomorrow, Sony would always own all of Bob Dylan's recordings, even if they weren't releasing them. And that becomes a terrible thing for an artist because he says, look, I've got this little label over here that would be happy to put out my records. You're not even putting them out. Could I just put them out there? And the answer is no. No, you can't. We own them. Hey, maybe you'll die in a plane crash and then they'll be worth something to us. And that's just one example. There's all kinds of stuff. As I get into in the novel, there are things that even the lawyers themselves admit are ridiculous. Most major record companies will say to a young band coming in, we'd like you to use our lawyer as your lawyer. Now think about that. The lawyers who are on retainer for the record companies are also representing the artists. So, you know, guess who the deals are going to favor? They're going to favor the record companies. So a lot of artists, as they've gotten older and wiser and been robbed, have said, boy, this isn't for me. But no one's been very successful in getting any of the major labels to change the basic way they operate. I mean, I suppose if you're Michael Jackson, you can go in and negotiate a better deal for yourself. But to sort of change those fundamentals of ownership, it's why Prince wrote Slave on his face and walked around like that for a couple of years. It was the realization that, wait, I'm paying for everything, I'm creating everything, and they own it all, and I can never, ever get it back.
On the one hand, you have these huge mega companies that are being accused of cutting really unfavorable deals with the artists. Deals unfavorable to the artists. On the other hand, these mega companies are feeling very threatened now by the internet. What are the greatest threats to the record companies now posed by the internet?
Well, the reason that it's a very interesting moment. The reason that the record companies have been able to impose these very unfavorable conditions on musicians is that basically the record companies own the pressing plants and the trucks. And that meant that they could say, we take 95% and you could take 5% after you've paid back all our costs, which you never will. Because just to get a record to the store in the United States, just to make sure that every Kmart in Oklahoma and every mom and pop store, you know, along the Canadian border has it, is an enormous undertaking. And until very recently, there was no way to get around the fact. And many artists tried. As early as the 70s, the Grateful Dead tried to set up their own label with their own pressing plant and their own distribution. They just couldn't get the records to the stores. So just a few people, seven at the beginning of the 90s and down to four, I think, now, had all the control because they had the pressing plants, they had the trucks, they had the relations with the big distributors. Often they owned the big distributors. What's so astonishing about the web, the internet, computers, is that suddenly you don't need a pressing plant and you don't need a truck to get into the music distribution business. Suddenly a kid in his bedroom can do it, can theoretically do it. This has caused an earthquake in the record business that started building about 1992 and more and more I'd hear record executives go, well, I think it'll be 2010 before they can pull it off, and I'll have my money and I'll be out of the business by then. It's what contributed to the general atmosphere of I've got to make a quick hit and get out of here because I don't know if it'll exist soon. And what's happened with Napster and MP3 is that it's been demonstrated that there are perhaps millions of people already anxious and, in fact, going out downloading music from the web. It's not a theoretical anymore. And it's gone from the record stores being concerned that they were going to be cut out a few years ago to now the record labels being scared that they're going to cut out. Because really, if you're REM, if you're U2, if you're Madonna, what do you need a record company for? Well, right now, people say, well, they still need them for marketing. Well, you could hire freelance marketing people. There's already a bit of people who have been laid off in the great record company mergers going out and starting freelance marketing companies, saying, hire me for 6 months. I'll do your ad campaign. I'll make sure that the presence is out there. We'll book the billboards and just pay me a fee. So we're entering a whole new world. The guys have had the gun to the artist's head forever because they own the trucks, and suddenly the trucks don't matter.
The RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, which is a lobbying group representing the major record labels, won a lawsuit against MP3. What did they win?
Well, that's perfectly fair. The RIAA has won, legitimately, I think, a lawsuit saying that you can't take our product and make it available to people without paying us a royalty for it. See, the only impediment right now to individual artists and labels turning the music industry entirely into a web-driven industry is that nobody's figured out how to get the money out. But that's kind of a matter of engineering. We can't be that far away from the day when you'll hit the button for the record you want and something will appear on your phone bill or you stick in your credit card number. That day hasn't arrived yet. It's a funny thing where the technology to deliver the product has arrived before the technology to get paid for delivering the product. So whether it's record companies or whether it's individual artists setting up their own distribution systems, there does have to be a way for people to get paid for the product.
Bill Flanagan is the author of a new novel set in the music industry called A&R. He's also senior vice president and editorial director of VH1. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. From Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation about the music business with Bill Flanagan, Senior Vice President of VH1. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the British band The Clash. And linguist Jeff Nunberg examines another expression in today's corporate jargon, thought leader. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Flanagan, author of the new novel A&R, which is set in the music industry. It's about an idealistic talent scout who leaves an independent record label to become head of artisan repertoire at a conglomerate. Flanagan is also senior vice president and editorial director at VH1. It seems that rock music has become so fragmented. There are so many different subdivisions within pop music now. What are some of them that, some of them beyond the obvious ones that you feel you have to keep up with?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about the moment we're in, and it's one of the things going on just under the surface of what's happening in A&R, is that we have, since Elvis Presley, certainly since the Beatles, been in a world where rock music was the basis of pop music. And that's sort of changing. I mean, hip-hop is really the basis for pop music now. If you turn on a top 40 station, most of what you hear comes out of rap and hip-hop and other modern black studio-created music. So rock's kind of going into its decline. I hate to say it because I love it, and I think that people my age, baby boomers, are going to always, we're going to carry it right through the python with us. But the fact is, it's not the center anymore. So you have an era that came to its full fruition with the Beatles and Bob Dylan and continued to keep replenishing itself through probably Nirvana in the mid-90s, finally being shoved out of the way. And that's another thing that's very hard for a whole generation of record executives to understand. See, the great old record executives, the great old assembly line guys like Mitch Miller, were pushed aside by the rise of rock. And now finally, as the baby boomers go into their 50s, they're being pushed aside by something new. I suppose it's inevitable, but it doesn't make it any less sad.
Do you find it very difficult to keep up with all the music coming out now?
One of the hardest things, I think, if you work in the music business, to do is to protect your own love of music. And it's absolutely crucial. It's the only thing that makes it worth doing. Otherwise, you might as well be selling shoes. So I really try to not try to stay on top of everything. I mean, obviously, I work at VH1. I'm in the middle of it. I get boxes of records for free every day. I get to go into every club in New York for free every night. So I see an awful lot of music. I hear an awful lot of music, and I know a lot more about what's going on than a civilian would. At the same time, I don't put any pressure on myself to feel I have to know everything about something just because it's trendy at the moment. Because what happens then is it starts to become product to you. It all starts to become the same thing. And I can get really excited when I find a new group. There's a Scottish group called Travis that I think could be the next U2. They're just tremendous. They've got great melodies, great songs. And I went to see them play at a club here in New York recently. And not only was the club packed to the rafters, but everybody in the audience knew the words to every song. That the fact that you can hear something like that. There's a guy who has a record out on Rykodisc, a fellow named Peter Bruntnell. I don't know anything about him. Apparently he's English. It's one of the most beautiful records I've heard in years. I don't even know what the guy looks like, but I play it over and over again. So I think what you want to do just to kind of keep your heart in it is to make sure that you cultivate the best part of yourself, the part of yourself that loves music, and you try not to be up on everything. You can't be up on everything.
I'm interested in how much time you spend in record stores and also in how you're using the internet now for music.
I do spend quite a lot of time in record stores because I like them. I worked in record stores for years when I was a kid, and I still like going in and trying to find something that I didn't know about or I haven't seen, or some old record that I loved that's just become available on an import CD or something. I'm also in the very fortunate position of having almost every record that's released sent to me for free. I've actually been in that fortunate position for 20 years. So I don't have to go, but I like to go. And you know, I'll find an excuse to go. I'll go looking for non-LP B-sides from England or something. It's something I've always enjoyed.
I don't
use the internet at all. I don't go on. I don't even read what people are saying about me because and I'm sure I would if I lived in Maine or something, if I were a little more on the outskirts, then I think I would take advantage of it. My kids take tremendous advantage of it. But I kind of feel like I have so much stuff coming at me all the time. I have so much mail I haven't opened. I have so many phone messages I haven't returned. I have so many people writing me and emailing me and trying to get my attention that the notion of any more input sort of would probably make smoke come out of my ears and I'd fall over in a heap. And there is something that, much as I completely appreciate the internet and I love what it means, personally, I don't need to know that much. You know, I just feel like my head's overstuffed anyway. And I find it a little bit, there's a scene in the novel where a great old rock star is shown at home just trolling all his websites and sort of eavesdropping on what his fans are saying about him and kind of disappearing up his own rear end. And I don't think we need to know that much, to tell you the truth.
Now, you created, I believe you created two of the shows on VH1, Legends and Storytellers.
Yeah, I take the credit for creating them. A lot of people were involved, but yes, I'll take the credit for
that. Okay. How did you and the people you're working with come up with the ideas for the shows?
Legends was a pretty obvious one. We wanted to be able to tell the whole life story of great musicians and explain where the music came from in kind of a Ken Burns Civil War approach. And that's what it began as, and although it's evolved a little bit, that's pretty much what it continues to be. Behind the Music, which is actually a more successful show, spun out of that because Jeff Gaspin, who's the head of production and a real creative guy, said, you know, there's a lot more good stories among the people who are not legends than there are among the legends. So that begat that. Storytellers, which is a show in which great singer-songwriters from all genres talk about how they wrote their songs and then play them for a very small audience, really came out of the notion of, gee, rock music doesn't seem to work very well on TV. When you go to Madison Square Garden and you see a big star with lights and lasers and mountains of amplifiers and he's making grand gestures, it's really exciting. It's really compelling. We are there at the Church of Rock and Roll, worshiping with our brothers and sisters, standing on our chairs. And yet, when I see that same performance on television, it seems overblown and pompous and kind of ridiculous. The sound isn't very good. You can't hear the bass and drums anymore. The grand gestures just look silly. And the effect of the lights and the smoke and all the other visual things going on is to just look kind of foggy and confused. So basically the notion was, we don't do that well on TV. Maybe we shouldn't do it, which immediately led to, well, what can TV do that you could never do in Madison Square Garden? And the answer was intimacy, direct communication. And we thought that if we could come up with a format in which musicians sat and talked directly to the camera, talked directly to the person sitting home on the couch about where the songs came from, and then played those songs, sort of the shed the light on them, told you the story, got you hooked, and then played them, that would be good television. And it would be something that you could not get anywhere else. And that's what Storytellers came out of. At first, we weren't even going to have a studio audience for Storytellers, but we realized that it's an awful lot easier for the musician to loosen up and be at his best if he's actually looking someone in the eye and talking to them. So we decided to bring in 100, 150 people and have them sit around the musician almost as if it were a party and let him talk directly. So when he's looking into the eye of the audience sitting 3 feet away from him, the camera picks it up as he's looking into the eye of the viewer.
Now, you mentioned that your show Legends led to Behind the Music.
Yeah.
And, you know, Behind the Music is, it's funny in a way because, you know, so many of the bands that are profiled on there have gone through these, like, miserable experiences of, like, drug habits and death of band members. And
Car crashes, overdoses.
Yeah.
Multiple divorces.
Accountants who fleece them from all of their profits.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm wondering if bands ever come to VH1 and say, we've had a lot of misery in our background. Can you do a show on us?
We have lots of nightmares to share. People come in with the parade of brutality.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
I should get a Behind the Music. We go, oh, I don't know, man. You know, I'm not sure everybody really remembers, you know, the flying mushroom. They go, let me tell you something. Three of our band members died. There was actually a pitch, which, I mean, I want to be careful to disguise this. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But there was a pitch which began with, two of our band members committed suicide. How's that?
Right. That's bizarre when you get pitched that way, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's the nature of television in the year 2000. I'm sure it's nothing compared to what Jerry Springer hears.
Well, Bill Flanagan, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it's been great, Terry. I've really enjoyed it.
Bill Flanagan is the author of a new novel set in the music industry called A&R. He's editorial director of VH1, where he created the shows Storytellers and Legends. Here's David Bowie performing on Storytellers. ¶¶
escape this feeling with my child, girl. I'm just a wreck without my little child, girl. I hear her heart beating. It's loud as thunder. I saw the stars crashing.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the British punk band The Clash. This is Fresh Air. In the late 1970s, punk rock was something people might have heard of, but few had heard. It was up to four young men from London, The Clash, to show them what it was about. One of their record company's ad campaigns called them the only band that matters. Today, in the first of two parts, rock historian Ed Ward tells us why.
London's burning! London's burning!
Let's get one thing straight. When it comes to the punk revolution that swept England in 1976 and 77, the Sex Pistols don't count. They were a cute idea, but a manufactured one, and they blew up before they could really make a difference. The Clash, now they mattered. Everything started the night Mick Jones, a kid who desperately wanted to be a pop star, met Bernie Rhodes, a young entrepreneur in a London club called the Nashville Rooms in 1976. Right away, the two decided to start a band and put an ad in a music paper looking for musicians. Over the next couple of months, various combinations came and went, and Rhodes settled into a management position. Finally, they felt they were good enough to approach an energetic guy who called himself Joe Strummer, whose band, the 101ers, was falling apart. Rhodes gave him 24 hours to make up his mind, and Strummer came to rehearsal the next day. Now, with the addition of the sharp-dressing bassist Paul Simonon, they had a band. They called themselves The Clash. From the start, they exuded seriousness. Songs like White Riot addressed the race and class issues young Britons found themselves enmeshed in. The career opportunities provided by the Thatcher government, which led to dead-end jobs, became another song. And then there was another song on which perhaps they weren't totally honest.
I'm so bored with the USA.
It was a good stance being bored with the USA, but the Clash couldn't help themselves. They had an insatiable curiosity about roots music, be it the urban reggae blasting across London or the mystery of blues and country music from the land that invented rock and roll. They vowed to conquer that country, but there was a small problem. The Clash, as first-generation punkers, never got involved with making their own records as the next wave did. Instead, they signed to CBS, a multinational conglomerate. The company, of course, was eager to have them, and the contract had many favorable clauses in it. But the hitch was that in America, the marketing guys refused to release The Clash's first album, believing nobody would buy it, and not wanting to sully the company's reputation with punk rock. They only relented a year after the record came out, at which point most of the American fans who'd wanted it already had it, and only a few would buy another copy to get the couple of extra tracks they'd slapped on to make it attractive. It was the first of a series of blows which would eventually kill the band. Meanwhile, they dumped their first drummer, Terry Chimes, and replaced him with Topper Hedden, and, loaded with optimism and a healthy infusion of record company cash, went into the studio with an American producer, Sandy Pearlman, who, it was thought, would give them a more radio-friendly album. He succeeded. Give Him Enough Rope debuted at number 2 on the British charts in November 1978, and the band announced an American tour for the next year. But even songs like Safe European Home, with its sing-along chorus and clear mix, failed to dent American radio, which had had a year to entrench itself against this new music. The Clash weren't worried. As one of their songs said, they were the last gang in town, and they were ready for war.
Ed Ward will be back with part 2 of his profile of The Clash tomorrow.
Never knock. Every job they offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. I hate the army and I hate the RAF. I don't wanna go fighting in the jungle. I hate the seven savage boom. I won't open that bomb for you. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to kick you off the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Oi, 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 enough. Every job they offer used to kick you out the door. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked.
Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg on an expression that has caught on in the business world, thought leader. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been examining expressions that have originated or caught on in the business world. Today he looks at the expression thought leader.
A while ago, I got an invitation to participate in a workshop on the future of knowledge as part of a group of distinguished thought leaders. Needless to say, I accepted. Thought leader. Nobody ever called me that before. I had half a mind to put it down under occupation the next time I have to fill out a credit application. Unfortunately, it turns out that my new status isn't quite as exclusive or as novel as I'd hoped. The phrase thought leader started its life around 20 years ago as a bit of marketing jargon to describe the sort of people who read magazines like The New Republic or The Atlantic. At its inception, it meant pretty much the same thing as opinion maker, which was the marketing jargon of the previous generation. But over the past few years, the phrase has been spreading itself around much more widely. Now thought leader is used for anybody who pretends to have influence over the way other people think. It's become de rigueur for management consultants to describe themselves as recognized international thought leaders, usually with some phrase like learning communities or change agents within a comma's throw. An insurance company describes itself as a thought leader in long-term care, whatever that might mean, and I found a web page that some consultant had put up that described Socrates as the first thought leader of knowledge management. It also turns out I was scooped on using thought leader as an occupational title. I ran into a job listing for a software company that was looking for a thought leader for its retail sales division and offering a salary in the 100-120 range. They didn't say what the job responsibilities were, but it's a safe bet that PowerPoint came into the picture somewhere. Now, I'm not about to begrudge anybody a job title that commands a six-figure salary. Still, there's something a little clumsy about the phrase. It feels like it should be in German, Gedankenführer. It's an awkwardness that seems to be endemic whenever we try to come up with words to talk about people who traffic in ideas. When thought leader and opinion maker were first introduced, after all, they were just expedients for avoiding the word intelligentsia or intelligentsia, probably because nobody was sure how to pronounce it. There was an article in Newsweek last fall that suggested that we think of thought leaders as something like lay intellectuals, but intellectual's a word with problems of its own. Americans are comfortable using it as an adjective when they're talking about intellectual property or a stimulating intellectual conversation. But when intellectual is used as a noun, it usually conjures up the image of woolly academics swollen with self-importance. It's striking how often the word intellectual is modified by phrases like self-styled and so-called. That was the attitude that George W. Bush was appealing to a while ago when he was answering questions about his poor college grades and his somewhat rudimentary grasp of geography and international politics. "I was never a great intellectual," he said, sounding pretty confident that the American electorate wouldn't hold that failing against him. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Gore was asked to make the same pledge before the campaign is out. The last successful presidential candidate who would have owned up to being an intellectual was Woodrow Wilson, who was president of Princeton back when college teaching and football were both gentlemen's games. Some commentators have been trying to get around this lingering prejudice by making the case for what they call public intellectuals. The phrase is usually associated with a nostalgia for the age of those mid-20th century thinkers who could talk to a wider audience without having clouds of chalk dust issue from their mouth. People like Edmund Wilson, Paul Goodman, and Lewis Mumford, not to mention Clifton Fadiman. Of course, it's likely that Wilson himself would have been dismayed by the phrase public intellectual with its intimations of excessive sociability. But I can understand the desire to make American intellectuals seem sexier, more like the way they're regarded in France. French talk show producers have Rolodexes full of historians and philosophers with Bee Gees hairdos who can appear on a half hour's notice and deliver themselves of exquisitely worded opinions on everything from mad cow disease to gangster rap. They're genuine celebrities, people whom everybody knows by their initials and who don't have to wait for tables in fancy restaurants. The French even have a slang word for intellectuals, intello. That couldn't happen here, where intellectuals are an obscure and dreary class. It would be like having a slang word for chemical engineers. In the end, though, I suspect that the phrase public intellectual is fighting a hopeless rearguard battle. The future belongs to the thought leaders. At least I've noticed that while sociologists and political scientists still like to describe themselves as intellectuals, the business school gurus who command the five-figure speaking fees have gone over to calling themselves thought leaders. That's probably all it takes to put the phrase over the top. In the marketplace of ideas, what matters is being able to move product.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, we begin a series of Monday broadcasts of our series on American popular song. We begin Monday with our program on Harry Warren, who wrote many of the songs for the Busby Berkeley movie musicals, including this song, We're in the Money.
With silver you can turn your dreams to gold. Oh, we're in the money, we're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money, the sky is sunny. Old Man Depression, you are through, you done us wrong. Oh, we never see headline about red line today. And when we see the landlord, we can look that guy right in the eye. Oh, we're in the money.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Harmony Books Division, publishers of Transistor Radio, a novel by Chris Bojalian, author of Midwives and The Law of Similars. And from Random House, Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, jazz bassist Milt Hinton. This month he turned 90. He's not only performed through the history of jazz, he's documented it through his photographs of fellow musicians. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's a simple rhythm. Ooh, with an easy lift.
Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah.
That's the rhythm of the